Marty Moscoane, welcome back to Radio Times. The last days of Edgar Allan Poe's life have always been a mystery. He was on a lecture tour but was found on October 3, 1849, on a street in Baltimore, apparently disoriented, distressed, and wearing someone else's clothes. He died a few days later. Our guests Thaddeus Phillips, Jeremy Wilhelm, and David Wilhelm have created a very moving theater piece about Poe's last days called Red Eye to Havre de Grace. They use Poe's letters to his mother-in-law, his poems, historical accounts, trains, haunting music and dance, and a few props to explore Poe's state of mind. This opera, as they call it, is at the Suzanne Roberts Theater tonight, tomorrow, Saturday, and Sunday. And all three of our guests join us here in our Philadelphia studios, and let me introduce them to you. Thaddeus Phillips is a director, stage designer, and co-creator of Red Eye to Havre de Grace. His production company, Lucidity Suitcase Intercontinental, has brought several productions to the Philly Live Arts, Philly Fringe. And nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be here. Thanks, Marty.
Also with us is Jeremy Wilhelm, co-creator, co-composer, narrator, and singer in Red Eye to Havre de Grace, and plays Ranger Steve. And he and his brother have founded a company called Wilhelm Brothers and Company. And Jeremy Wilhelm, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome. And also with us, David Wilhelm, co-creator, co-composer of the music of Red Eye to Havre de Grace, a multi-instrumentalist and composer. In fact, has brought his guitar to our studios. And David Wilhelm, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks, Marty.
I wish our listeners could have seen what has been going on in the last couple minutes in the studios. We got everyone into their place, and David is actually going to play a piece from the play and also perform on his guitar. Jeremy's going to sing. But let me begin with you, Thaddeus. I know this play has been several years in the making, maybe many years in the making. What's the germ that started this Red Eye?
Well, I had done a lot of versions, one with Jeremy, one with my mother, one with other Philadelphia artists, James Sugg, and based on Poe.
Right.
But the Red Eye version really started when we focused on Poe's death and the fact that he was on these trains from Baltimore to Philadelphia trying to get up to New York. And just the idea of Poe on a train really sparked our imagination when I got to work with Jeremy on the Red Eye to Havre de Grace version. And so it was that in combination with also what Jeremy discovered were the letters that Poe wrote to his mother-in-law, and that those would make much more interesting material for songs than Poe's poems and stories. So it was really, I think it's the discovery of Poe on a train.
Yes.
And putting letters to his mother-in-law were the two largest creative factors to construct all of our various Poe material from various versions to become Red Eye to Havre de Grace.
And where did you find those letters, Jeremy?
I had a little portable Poe copy that Thaddeus and I had when we were doing a show in London. And I was using that as the material to make songs from the poems way back in 97.
Huh.
I was taking songs like, or the poems like The Bells and Annabelle Lee and things like that, and turning them into songs, and it was easy enough to do because the lyrics are already there for you, the meter is already there for you. But then we started looking, I started reading these letters, and that he's such a lyrical writer anyway, and the songs that came out of trying to stick the lyricism that's already inherent into his writing in these letters into some kind of a song structure. The songs just popped out as being really much more original sounding.
And his mother-in-law, who he referred to as Muddy, also his aunt, because just to complicate things, he had married his cousin, who was, 13 years younger than
Virginia.
Him?
Mm-hmm.
Virginia.
Yeah, Virginia.
And she haunts him through this production.
Yeah, I mean, that was the simple idea is that, by 1849, Virginia died, I think, in 47. So he'd been trying to reestablish some kind of home life, but kind of running around, and they were living up in the Bronx. The cottage is still there; you can go visit it. And so Poe's only real connection was Muddy, his mother-in-law, and she was the one who would like edit his works, would try to get him into editors, would try to sell them because Poe was such a mess. So
yes.
She was also like his agent, and that was all he really had.
Are there letters from Muddy to Poe that have survived? It'd be interesting to see what that correspondence
there's
might
a couple.
Have been about.
Then there's a fascinating letter that Muddy wrote to a doctor or a friend in Philadelphia, because when Poe died in Baltimore, Muddy found out that he died, and so did his fiancée he had down in Richmond, from an obituary from the Baltimore Sun. Right. So there's this amazing frantic letter that she wrote back to someone in Philadelphia because Poe had lost his suitcase in the train station, trying to recover that suitcase, and very concerned about how Poe died and trying to grab any detail she could find. So that's a really interesting letter from Muddy.
Yeah. It's that obsessive intimacy between these in these letters that are the
They're
craziest
very
things.
Intense.
Oh, I don't know what kind of weird codependent relationship they had, but it was crazy.
Well, I actually do want to play, and this is from the CD, Most of My Suffering. But even before we do that, David, we're going to hear some of the music that's built around this particular letter. How did you approach these letters as a composer?
Jeremy was really great at setting the lyrics to a melody and to the rhythm and getting everything set in that sense. And then I would come in with sort of this palette of the prepared piano, which you'll hear jingle, jangle, percussive sounds coming out of the piano, and we would just sort of build the sound around that, take the melodies, set them nicely over a harmonic structure, and go from there.
What do you mean by prepared? People are going to hear it, but I want them to understand, what are they hearing
right.
when they hear a prepared piano?
Prepared piano is a technique that John Cage developed number of years ago. In the 40s, he had developed it extensively, which basically involves just inserting random objects into the piano strings to make it sound completely different. So that can be nuts and bolts, it can be screws, it can be gum, it can be rubber, it can be bouncing balls, it can be anything on the piano strings that change and alter the sound. You can even alter the piano hammers themselves by adding thumbtacks. It just changes the texture of the sound completely.
So you didn't retune the piano.
Everything
objects
is just,
then
yep,
make,
done to
make
the strings.
Sound.
Yep. So you'll hear completely different sounds. I use the pedals a lot in this recording. You just crank it away on the pedals. It gives it a really nice percussive thing, too. So
let's listen. This is Most of My Suffering from the Red Eye to Havre de Grace. Most of My Suffering from the Wilhelm Brothers and Company soundtrack to the production of Red Eye to Havre de Grace. And I should add that's Ian Sheehy playing Edgar Allan Poe. And I just have to say to our listeners, Thaddeus, you had not heard that before, right?
No, not that exact recording.
It's very haunting, though, I have to say. And I think your description also of what we're hearing from the piano, David, mm-hmm. helps us understand a little bit about Poe's mind.
It certainly can. The studio version has bass and drums as well. In the live show, we don't have that. So we definitely have a lot more prepared piano sound in the live show and all the sound sources there.
Yeah. And those words, I mean, this is a letter, but those words, I think, work so well.
Yeah, this is a crazy letter. When he has these fantasies about seeing her dead and imagining himself dead with her in a couple of these letters. Yeah. And because we were moving towards his death, we sort of focused on these two key letters for me. This song used to sit. This is an interesting thing for our transcription from the 2005 production of Red Eye to today's production of Red Eye, is that we started to move these songs around as building blocks. So this used to be a big sort of Brechtian kickoff production number to the Act 3. We used to have our Virginia with angel wings fly up into the front of the stage, and she and I would just sit there or stand there at the front of the stage and sing very loud and straight out to the audience.
Wow.
Had no idea what it was about necessarily. And now it's more of a texture of his following his sort of psyche through the piece.
And so, one senses his sort of mental collapse as time goes on.
I mean, that was one thing we discovered, is that if you take a song and give Poe a simple action, so while the song's being sung, like when Virginia, quote-unquote, gets him drunk by sneaking into his hotel room, and we hear the Laudanum song, or when we hear Most of My Suffering, it's when Poe's changing his clothes, trying to disguise himself, where he ends up in the straw hat and the burlap pants. Right. So we kind of stage that moment to the song, and it allows you just to see a simple action with these really strong lyrics, but not too much else happening on stage, so you can kind of really hear the words.
Yes.
Yeah.
And Virginia, who was Poe's wife, who died a couple of years before this time in his life, played by Sophie
Bortolussi.
Bortolussi, and she's an incredible dancer, mover across the stage, really literally just haunting him through this whole production.
Yeah, I was seeing Sleep No More in New York, which is that version of Macbeth set in all these hotel rooms, and she was playing Lady Macbeth, so I think you wear a mask, and I saw her, she was naked, completely wet, in a bathtub, shivering, and I was like, oh, she could be Virginia, so I tracked her down, and we talked to her, and Tatiana and I talked to her in a park in New York, and then we cast her and convinced her to do this with us. So that was pretty great.
Are you a fan of Edgar Allan Poe, Thaddeus?
Well, it's interesting. Of his writings, not so much. Of the cliche of his writings. But once we started to get deeper into this and we discovered the real array of his writings, which include the things on furniture and especially Eureka and the Adventures of Arthur Gordon Pym, which is kind of based on Moby Dick is based off that. You know, there's actually a much broader base of... He invented the first hoax. He said that a balloon crossed the Atlantic in 3 days. That was in the New York papers. Everyone believed it, very similar to Orson Welles' hoax with the War of the Worlds. So then I got much more fascinated.
Fiction.
In detective fiction.
Yeah, Sherlock Holmes is totally ripped off from Poe.
So considering that, and especially Eureka, I became a much bigger fan of his. When you get beyond the cliché, I think he's a much more interesting writer.
Well, and we're almost up in a break here, but the cliché is the Raven, and I have to say during this action opera, everyone says, well, could you do the Raven for us? And I guess someone with the greatest hits has to deal with that.
Yeah. Yeah, we even read that, like, people recognize him on the streets of New York. Kids would recognize him, and they'd say, could you do the Raven? And he would say, nevermore, to get the kids to run away, you know, on the streets of New York.
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We are talking with Thaddeus Phillips, David Wilhelm, and Jeremy Wilhelm, and their action opera, as they call it, is here in Philadelphia, and the action opera is called Red Eye to Havre de Grace. It's part of the Philadelphia Live Arts Festival and Philly Fringe, and it's at the Suzanne Roberts Theater tonight, tomorrow, Saturday, and Sunday. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, and have a in-studio concert as well. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY. Independence Blue Cross is dedicated to transforming healthcare to make a better coordinated system that is built around you. They're committed to leading the way to focus on preventing illness rather than reacting to it, pioneering new ways to pay healthcare professionals based on the quality of care, and using technology to update your medical information electronically so everyone can be informed. Further details online at ibx.com. Independence Blue Cross, changing the game.
Can you grow garlic in containers over the winter? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll change our position on this topic of great importance to ground-free growers. Plus, the easiest and most difficult fruits and answers to all your growing questions. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturday morning at 11, right here on WHYY-FM.
When NFL linebacker Brendan Ayan Badejo expressed his support for same-sex marriage, a prominent critic tried to tell him to keep his mouth shut and just play ball. But the defensive star is going on the offense off the field.
It's everybody's issue. Every American has the right to be treated fairly.
More on why he's speaking out on same-sex marriage next time on Tell Me More.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with Jeremy and David Wilhelm and Thaddeus Phillips about an action opera, as they call it, Red Eye to Havre de Grace, again in Philadelphia at the Philadelphia Live Arts Festival and Philly Fringe. And we are actually going to do a small little impromptu concert here, but Thaddeus, let me have you set it up for us, and then we're going to hear David on guitar, and Jeremy's going to sing.
Well, in dealing with Poe's death, one of the main sequences we use is this crazy story of Poe in July of 1849. In Philadelphia, apparently he jumped off a train, went to his friend's house, Dr. Sartain's on Samson Street, demanded that his mustache get shaved because these people who were trying to kill him wouldn't recognize him. And then he went to the train station. Well, first he went on a walk to the Philadelphia Waterworks with Dr. Sartain, and then went to the train station. And so this is that sequence... explains also a story where Poe explains how he was locked up at Moymensing Prison for passing a counterfeit bill, which is now the Acme on Passyunk. And so this whole series of really weird events we stage. We stage the waterworks. We stage him getting his mustache shaved. There's a lot of very cinematic action with simple transformations. And at one point, he arrives in a train station in Baltimore, right when he arrives in Baltimore, and he thinks he's trying to get to New York. And this is a premonition of his death. There's a song called Die Together, but the source of the song is a letter to Muddy from the crazy time in Philadelphia. So it's from July 7th, and it says, "My dear, dear mother, I've been so ill, I've had the cholera or spasms quite as bad, and now can hardly hold the pen. The very instant that you get this, come to me. The joy of seeing you will almost compensate for our sorrows. We can't but die together. There's no use to reason with me now. I must die. I have no desire to live, since I have done Eureka. I could accomplish nothing more. For your sake, it would be sweet to live, but we must die together. You have been all in all to me, darling, ever-beloved mother, and dearest, truest friend. I was never really insane, except on occasions when my heart was touched. I have been taken to prison once since I came here for a drunken spree, but I was not. It was about Virginia." So that's the letter that Poe wrote to his mother-in-law and the Wilhelm brothers.
Some turtles here from the Wilhelm brothers.
Yeah.
Yes, go ahead.
It's this climatic moment in the Baltimore train station where Poe is realizing this visual gesture about the universe in Eureka that he's been getting physically from the ghost of his dead wife throughout the show. And then we put that song, that letter, to music.
The very instant that you get this, come to me. The joy of seeing you will almost compensate for our sorrows. We must die together. We can but die together. It is no use to reason with me now. I must die. I have no desire to live, since I have done Eureka. I can accomplish nothing more. For your sake, it would be sweet to live, but we must die together. We can but die together. I was never really insane, except on occasion when my heart was touched.
Wow, beautiful. And that's a song from the production of Red Eye to Havre de Grace, and performed by two of our three guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studios, Jeremy Wilhelm, singing his brother David Wilhelm on guitar. Thank you very much. That was real. I mean, it was a mad dash to get you into your seats and to set that up. And my kudos to our engineer, Kevin Griffin, for pulling that off in just a couple of minutes. But it's, you know, first of all, to hear the letter and then to hear you sing those words. Mm-hmm. And that line about being insane, feeling insane when my heart was touched. Yeah, I mean, it's heartbreaking to hear this.
It is. I even remember writing that song, actually. It was in this warehouse. The National Furniture Company's warehouse on 2nd and Arch? We were rehearsing in there in the middle of July. And sometimes we would break off and have to go make something for a certain section. I think they were building that very walk, his sort of death walk. And we had this letter, and I walked away with a guitar and sort of came back with this weird sort of rock anthem version of it. Yeah. Because the styles in our piece are all over the map musically. Stuff sounds like Kurt Weill almost writing for Bertolt Brecht. Sometimes it sounds like a Tom Waits song. Sometimes it sounds like a Bon Jovi song. I don't know. It's all over the place.
That's kind of good. Go ahead, David.
Yeah, and we just laughed because really orchestration-wise, it just needed an upright bass. We thought like that would be perfect with just an upright bass. But of course, you know, I think we actually looked for an upright bass.
Yeah.
I said, sure, I can.
But then David's like, I can just go inside the piano and make
and
that.
And so I just go in, and it's literally three or four notes on the bass strings of the piano that are muted with sticky tack so that they don't resonate much. There's just sort of a dull, and it sounds a bit like an upright bass, and it works.
Yeah, we never do that with guitar in the show. David fills a little guitar in on the record, actually, as a solo. But
I think what's interesting about those letters is there's these weird details about what Poe was thinking himself. Practically, which is I have no desire to live since I have done Eureka. This written July 1849, he dies in October 1849, and Eureka was finished in 1849. And when he wrote Eureka, which he would explain to Muddy on long walks in the Bronx, he was convinced that would be his greatest work. He met with an editor, right, and he was like, I'd like a million copies, and they'd like print it. And they said, well, we could do 500, and he's like, okay. That's fine. And it's a really crazy essay, but he has a lot of interesting theories about like the Big Bang and the primordial particle, which to me was amazing because of the discovery in July of this year of the Higgs boson particle. Yes. And this is exactly what Poe is talking about. And no one cared. No one was interested. It really destroys God. The regular religious notion of God, that's not good in 1849. And so no one really listened to this important thing he really wanted to say, which was sad. They wanted to hear the raven and stuff. And so the discovery of Eureka and all these clues about it, I think, are a really beautiful, interesting link into the whole play. And that's what leads up to the final scene on the bowed piano, where we allow him to do Eureka.
Well, and I don't want to give too much of this opera away, but if I can turn back to you, David, and what we see on stage is Poe and his, I guess, final moments, and he's reciting Eureka, and everyone else is, and I couldn't quite figure out what was going on, but bowing the piano. Again, can you describe what's happening to that piano?
Yeah, we use essentially bows that are made out of nylon fishing line that are then covered with rosin so that it gives them some texture and they can actually get contact with the string. We pass them underneath the strings of the grand piano and then put the damper down so that they can resonate and move freely, and then you just move the bow back and forth the nylon fishing line, and it causes a sustained sound in the piano.
Wow. Like a drone, almost.
Like a drone, exactly. The whole concept was pioneered by Stephen Scott at the Colorado College, where all three of us were all alumni. I used to play in the ensemble there.
You've toured, right?
Yeah. 10 people would gather around 1 9-foot piano and all play. You know, it's sort of like a bell choir, where you need 5 people to make a melody that goes up 5 notes. So it becomes this very, very intricate operation of trying to not run into people's hands when you're bowing and not get bow tangles and whatnot. We have a very simplified version. We only have 3 performers available to make the melodies. But as the final scene, it's absolutely perfect because it does. It looks like an operating room where we're just diving in and you can see these bows moving around and hands moving and Poe is prone on the piano right there.
Yeah, and the combination of that of, you know, like you mentioned before the break, Marty, about the raven.
Yes.
Is, you know, Poe has to do the raven, and we make him do the whole raven in the show in front of the audience officially, but on his deathbed, on this piano, we allow him to do Eureka, which is nice because, you know, there's an audience getting to hear Eureka. But what we are saying is the only chance he really did Eureka was alone in that room in Baltimore, in that Washington College Hospital.
Yeah, I think that...
And that's really sad.
Right. The Ian, when in some of Ian's research, he found, I mean, he told me, and I didn't realize this,
Ian is playing Poe.
He researched the role really pretty extensively. He's telling me that Poe for 4 days talked nonstop, and so probably was doing Eureka, just nonstop.
In a kind of deranged
state, just like sort of, just stream of consciousness stuff. So that, I think, informs the way that all rolls out.
And that's Jeremy Wilhelm, who joined us along with David Wilhelm and Thaddeus Phillips, talking about the creation, what went into their action opera, Red Eye, to Havre de Grace here in Philadelphia, part of the Philadelphia Live Arts Festival and Philly Fringe. Can I go back to you, David, because I think what we see, and you're on stage playing various pianos and sort of weird incarnations of pianos, is that... You see that a piano is more than just those keys. I mean, you have turned that into a completely different instrument.
Yeah, we've opened up both of the pianos, actually. The reveal on the grand piano doesn't come until the end, but the upright piano, which is a fantastic old piano that we got here locally. Thanks, Judy. we've opened up, we've taken off the covers, and you can see all of the action on the inside. You can see all of the strings and the harp on the bottom. And we've actually got lights on it, and it's completely mobile on casters. So it moves around the stage, and lights come up on it at very tasteful moments, I think.
I hope, but
you can
really,
you can see, I think that's thanks to Thaddeus and Drew.
It's okay.
Yeah, the lights in the piano run off a car battery.
Truly?
On a remote dimmer,
Yeah, and there's wireless mics inside the piano.
Using the word haunting, but it is a haunting effect. I want to play another song, and this is, and we should say that there is this train motif. This is a song called I Must Have Fallen Asleep from Wilhelm Brothers and Company's soundtrack. Has an interesting, I guess, beginning, and I'm not sure who I should I look at
sure,
you, Jeremy,
sure, sure.
for the version?
No, it was when we were rehearsing in that dank, dark warehouse in the middle of July or June or something. In 2005, we needed some inspiration for this train stuff. We were having trouble with the staging or just getting new ideas for the staging, so we decided, oh, what are some films that we know that we love that have train sequences in them? So we went to Lars von Trier's film, Zentropa, and we all sat in Thaddeus' parents' house, and we watched this thing, and in the middle of that, there's this train conductor who comes on. I play various train conductors throughout the course of the during the course of the show, and there's this amazing train conductor, and Lars von Trier wrote a little speech for him, and we all loved it. It had a kind of lyricism to it. We laughed. For some reason, we just lifted it, the speech word for word, gave that speech to the train conductor, and then also wrote a song that sort of punctuates a sort of nightmare expressionistic sequence that Poe has in the middle of that train trip.
Which is important because Poe is trying to get from, Richmond to New York, and he keeps getting confused. And when he was going once to Baltimore, thought he was going to New York. So this song plays into the fact of losing direction and getting confused in Poe's mind. So,
well, let's listen. This is I Must Have Fallen Asleep.
I must have fallen asleep. It's very embarrassing. You see, normally I have problems falling asleep. But when I hear the sound of the wheels on the rails, I become drowsy. And now and then I fall. When I wake up, I'm ice cold, it's frightening. And then there's the feeling that I don't know in which direction the train is moving. I don't know if we are going forwards or backwards. For what I thought was forwards has suddenly become backwards. Very embarrassing. You see, normally
That's I Must Have Fallen Asleep with a full chorus here, but on stage at Red Eye to Havre de Grace, you don't hear the chorus, but that's a song from this action opera that we've been talking about. And David, if I can turn to you, and I guess both you and Jeremy compose this together, or as brothers, is there a certain chemistry synergy you think you have as collaborators?
Well, David has much more musical training than I do in terms of orchestration, so I'll come up with a really goofy, simple melody set to this and call David and play it to him over the phone or whatever, and then he will round it out, as we say. I mean, he's playing.
Is that what
piano.
You do, David?
Round it out?
I do remember when he called me with Most of My Suffering, just humming this little tune, Most of My Suffering, and he already had the bass line as well.
On the piano.
That one was, almost fully realized when it came my way. So,
and how many instruments do you play?
In the show, I play bassoon, prepared pianos, bowed piano, and flamenco guitar.
And how about in real life?
Add accordion to that, I think, and that's about it.
That's about it.
Yeah.
You play several characters in this play, including Ranger, Steve.
Yeah, really. I mean, we used to think of it in terms of several characters. Now it's really the central character who's always some kind of an official authority figure or guide. I mean, really, he's a sort of spirit guide in a weird sort of postmodern sense for Poe. So, who, as a tour guide who knows everything about his life, is, in a kind of weird metaphysical way, taking him through this nightmare of his last train trip. So he's always the conductor. He's always this friend he runs into who's going to either help him or not. And so we're sort of thinking of all those different characters that I play as sort of one entity now that Poe keeps running into.
Oh, that's interesting. And I know you went to the Poe house. It's not far from here, Thaddeus. And I mean, it's a great place to visit with some incredible people on staff there.
Well, the Poe, I mean, indirectly, I was at Independence Hall and I saw the park ranger. We were showing some friends in town that. And that's when I was like, wait a minute, the Poe house has a park ranger. And that's a great modern key into the show. It's like a way, because the ranger can, you know, bring the current. And every time I see a ranger walk down the street or in Yellowstone or wherever, it brings me right back into the show. And so I was kind of looking for a modern window. So that was a major eureka moment in the way we could structure this thing. And the other thing I realized is when we have just, you know, three performers in the orchestra being David, is the earlier version, it was like a hybrid, this kind of hybrid of arts where everyone dances and sings and we're doing physical theater together. And then the more we started, I was like, that's not a good idea. It's a better idea to get an actor who's going to act Poe. And he's going to do what he does best by acting. And a dancer, not a physical theater, a dancer to play Virginia. And highlight Jeremy singing more and actually use these three separate things to create one thing.
Hmm.
Which has been kind of a goal in this, which has been great because Ian is a very realistic actor, and Sophie's such a great dancer, and Jeremy sings like crazy.
Yeah, he does sing like crazy. Well, we're going to take another short break, get back to our conversation talking about Red Eye to Havre de Grace and more music. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY and recognizes Ovarian Cancer Awareness Month. More than 20,000 women will be diagnosed with ovarian cancer this year. The single most important risk factor for ovarian cancer is family history of the disease. Fox Chase offers risk assessment, genetic counseling, and a comprehensive range of treatment options. Patients have access to Fox Chase's multidisciplinary team-based approach, along with current clinical trials. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase Cancer Center, now part of the Temple University Health System. On the next Fresh Air, comic W. Kamau Bell, host of the FX series Totally Biased, which brings an African-American perspective to political comedy. On one of Bell's comedy tours, to attract a multicultural audience, he made this offer.
If you bring a friend of a different race, you get in two for one.
Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Chicago's teachers are striking in part over how their performance will be measured. So how do you grade teachers fairly? Also, Molly Ringwald turns from acting to fiction writing in a new novel of connected short stories. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with Thaddeus Phillips, Jeremy Wilhelm, and David Wilhelm. They've created a frankly, very moving theater piece about Edgar Allan Poe's last days called Red Eye to Havre de Grace. They use Poe's letters to his mother-in-law, some of his poems, historical accounts, trains and train schedules, some haunting music and dance, and some props, very few props, to explore Poe's state of mind. It's at the Suzanne Roberts Theater, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. All three of them obviously joining us today on Radio Time to talk about how they put all this together. We've been playing some music, and we had an impromptu little concert as well. If I can go back to you, Thaddeus, and this is, as I said, a piece that you've been working on for a number of years now. How do you know when you're done? You know, when you say, okay, This is Red Eye, and we are done with this.
Well, I know when we did this before in 2005, I mean, we all liked it. Everyone really liked it. But it was something we always wanted to revisit, and it was done on a shoestring budget. And so basically, I've referred to that video recently to see something. We completely overhauled everything from the lighting, the sound design, the structure of the songs. And so, and in a way, the part of the difficulty in this process is the budget. We have some funding from Pew, and Live Arts has helped a lot, but it's still not that huge of a budget for what it looks like. Mm-hmm. We built this like a very fancy production with very little means, and it's deceptively simple because we really only have the three set elements, the table, the door, and the bed representing the ranger, Poe, and Virginia, and then the two pianos. But the way we use the theater is kind of crazy, with the curtains overhauling when they come down instead of go up, and all of the flying things, and the American flag, and the wings, and the trap doors. So the idea was to kind of use the theater and expose it and open it up in a design sense. But in the end, also show that we're actually not using anything. You know, when they do the bow and we turn on all the work lights, you see it's four performers, the piano. I mean, there's actually nothing there.
Yes.
And so that was kind of the goal, is to create the most vivid, visually striking, you know, very large image pictures, a lot of cool movement with actually not using really anything. The entire set would fit in a van and we could drive it anywhere.
Is it hard to sustain that kind of interest on a production piece over that such a long period of time? I mean, would you, I'm assuming you go out and do other things and then come
back
to
I mean, yeah, when we came back to this, we've been working on this version since November, but only in like 4 weeks over, you know, we'll meet for a week and then take 3 months off and then meet for 2 weeks, you know. And so at this point, now that we've overhauled this the way we wanted to and organized the music in a great way, we're just doing little tweakings to make it flow better. But I mean, it's essentially done. So you can know it's done when it's done, you know. It also, the inherent structure of Poe's story, the letters and the songs are so tight. It's not one of these more experimental pieces where you really could kind of do anything. I mean, the show found itself, and we're just trying to clean it and solidify it. And that was kind of easy because so much structure and material is there with Poe's last journeys on these trains and getting lost in Baltimore. I mean, that's an amazing story just in itself. And our goal is to try to tell it in it. Interesting way.
And Jeremy, it's interesting to watch you and the other actors using the props. I mean, it is mostly just, there's a suitcase, a door that becomes a table that becomes a bed.
Right.
And all the ways that it's, you see it sort of transforming from one piece of furniture to another.
All the raw materials are right there. I mean, Thaddeus and I both studied with this crazy Bulgarian puppet designer, actually, at Colorado College years ago, who ended up being a mentor to all of us, really, artistically in many, many ways. Encho Avramov is his name. And I think he actually pushed Thaddeus to make the first version of the Raven in a class
of his.
So it was the Raven. Yeah. He was just like, stage some little poem, right?
Yeah.
So it was like you and Mooney.
Staged it with sticks and like five dancers, you know, and did a visual. Yeah, and the idea is to use the minimal amount of means to the maximum effect. Which is the way Poe kind of lived, but and that design sense, I think, opens the audience mind more, because it's not this like set that's just there and that's what you're going to see. It's like just a door, and then boom, we're at the Philadelphia Waterworks with like a huge blue backlight, you know. So in a way, it engages actively the audience's imagination more in the experience of watching the play as we're performing it,
right?
Or they're performing it.
And David, you're on stage performing the whole time, playing various pianos. Do you feel like you're in a role there? Are you? How do you think of, I guess, your character, if that's a correct
way? Yeah, I'm a workhorse, just up there, just cranking away. It's actually, physically, it's quite taxing because I'm working the pedals at the piano almost constantly for, you know, 20 minutes at a time. Last night, I think my legs started to cramp up a little bit and
really?
I shift around a little. But yeah, no, I feel, yeah, I mean, Poe's reacting to the music. Mm-hmm. It's definitely just, it's another character in and of itself.
And there are times the piano is moving and you're still playing,
playing
or someone
it.
Is, mm-hmm. or Virginia, I guess,
is
climbing
over
all
it.
Over you while you're playing
and
as po well.
And Poe and the park
sheets,
ranger.
Props boots, fall
yeah.
on him.
Yeah.
Yeah, that new staging of David really showcases that he's an engine driving the middle of it. I mean, the piano used to be over to the side. Now it's like right in the middle of the stage.
Yeah.
He's right in the middle of the action. There's no way to hide, nowhere to run, sort of showcasing the idea that there's only four of us.
Yes.
And all the sounds coming from there. I mean, we had a great sound designer this time around who,
yeah.
like, who really took the raw materials.
Rob Kaplowitz,
yeah.
he's a Tony Award winner, and, I mean, it shows. Just incredible, because he isolates the tink sound, the high ends and the low ends of the piano all around. So when you're sitting there, you feel like, when I watch the show, and these guys haven't had the experience of that, you think you're in the piano, like a little, I don't know if you felt that, Mark, but like the way the sounds are bouncing all over that room is just extraordinary. Thanks, Rob. And Drew's
yeah.
lighting, who lights a lot for the opera, here in town, just created such a beautiful sculptural lighting on each mood, and it's like a painting.
Mm. Yeah, it's weird. It's like the musical elements, the lighting elements, the scenography, our acting styles, everything is, it's so minimalized. It's all very, it's like focused very tightly, and I think that all of those things work in orchestra with each other.
Well, I want to play another song, and this is from the CD that we got from Wilhelm Brothers and Company soundtrack to the production of Red Eye 2, Havre de Grace, and this is Tincture of Opium, and again, it's words by Edgar Allan Poe, not a poem, but a letter to Muddy, and that's his mother-in-law / aunt. Let's listen.
I went to bed, wept through a long, long, hideous night of despair. When the day broke, I arose and endeavored to quiet my mind by a rapid walk in the cold, keen air. But all would not do. Demon tormented me still. Without returning to my hotel, I took the train back to Boston. When I arrived, I wrote you a letter in which I opened my whole heart to you. Having written this letter, I swallowed half the laudanum and journeyed to post office, intending now to take the rest till I saw you. But before I reached the post office, my reason was entirely gone.
Tincture of Opium from the Wilhelm Brothers and Company soundtrack to the production of Red Eye to Havre de Grace. Again, words by Edgar Allan Poe, a letter that he wrote to Muddy, his mother-in-law, who also was his aunt. David Wilhelm, piano. Jeremy Wilhelm, is that you? No.
I was singing.
You were singing.
Yeah, and then Jeremy Hauer, our percussionist back in Minneapolis, was playing drums on that track.
And this is this prepared piano.
Mm-hmm.
I think we hear that, David, really loud and clear.
Yeah,
that
it's very exposed in that song. So
right, and kind of think. I mean, sort of takes me back to maybe a piano in the 19th century at a bar or something.
A ruined barroom piano, exactly. Yeah, it definitely has that. It has gamelan sounds. It has random percussive sounds.
Right.
Yeah.
You two brothers have traveled together, performing together, doing other pieces, productions.
Well, production-wise, we do some other theaters. I mean, we're based in Minneapolis, and so we work in various capacities as theater artists there. David and I have, you know, do our own shows together. That I work with playwrights there and stuff. Mm-hmm. But we have this band called the Wilhelm Brothers and Company, and then a couple of break-off different projects. So David, for example, lived in Spain, and we want to do all this crazy sort of Spanish-influenced music with our percussionist and a different project, and then we do a funny Gordon Lightfoot cover band.
I was going to ask that Lightfoot comes alive. I mean, of all the people to pick for a cover band, is this because you love Gordon Lightfoot or you don't love Gordon Lightfoot?
I think a little bit of both. It's like he's not as ironic as someone like Neil Diamond, which would be a cliche for a cover band, but everyone kind of loves it, and then it's still kind of cheesy at the same time, so... Yeah. It's a really fun project. Everybody loves that thing. There aren't any Gordon Lightfoot
cover bands. No, I can't imagine. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, we grew up listening to Gord's Gold. My mom would put it on. Our mom would put it on when she cleaned the house every Sunday, and that was that. So the songs are just there as a part of our being. So.
I was going to say soundtrack of your childhood.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, I do want to play El Dorado and maybe giving you a chance, David, to talk about flamenco guitar and your interest in Spanish sounding music?
Yeah, I fell in love with the flamenco guitar in 1998, and I was fortunate enough to get a grant to go study in Spain, and I ended up living in Cádiz in southern Spain for a number of years. It's a beautiful place, and I fell in love with the music, obviously, and the culture and everything surrounding this flamenco. Thaddeus, of course, has been trying to figure out a way to get a flamenco sounding guitar into the show.
Oh,
and we
right?
finally made it happen this time around with this song, El Dorado, which is, you know, another poem.
Yeah. And why did you want...
Well, when you're working as a director and creator, you look at the resources you have in front of you. So if David can play flamenco guitar, there's a resource right there.
Right.
And everyone's like, that doesn't make any sense. And finally it was like, you know, he's in this weird bar in Baltimore. Virginia's on stilts. I mean, everything's twisted. Poe's about to die. He finally wants a real nice tequila. And so it makes perfect sense to use the poem El Dorado in a flamenco style to... send Poe off, really, to the hospital in Baltimore. So that's how that happened.
Well, let's listen. This is El Dorado. El Dorado with David Wilhelm basically doing all the parts, yes, that we're listening to there.
Yeah, with the exception of the cajon, everything else.
Oh,
Palmas,
yeah,
guitar and piano are me.
And is palmas, is that a Spanish word for clapping?
For clapping, yeah.
For clapping.
And there are professional palmeros in Spain that make their living clapping, so.
Really? Mm-hmm. And is that a distinctive style of clapping?
It is. It's called palmas seco. It's for flamenco. It's used to accompany flamenco, and it gives it that really dry, crisp rhythm. So.
We actually have Sophie Berlusi starts singing that song. It's to the poem El Dorado is where it comes from. So in the show, she sings along with that at the beginning, and then we are all singing it by the end of this big drinking game.
Yeah, I mean, like we frame the show with El Dorado, like so Poe's on the train and they're saying weird stuff, and he goes, "What's the purpose of your journey?" And Poe goes, "What can you keep a secret?" And he goes, "I can try." And he goes, "Gaily bedight, a gallant knight in sunshine and in shadow had journeyed long, singing a song, in search of El Dorado. Over the mountains of the moon, down the valley of the shadow, ride, boldly ride, if you seek for El Dorado." And the idea of Poe seeking for El Dorado, that poem was written in 1849, Eureka was written in 1849, Annabelle Lee was written in 1849. Most of the stuff we're using was written in the year of his death, and it's some of the most interesting stuff. So El Dorado is used as a theatrical device to frame the beginning of the show, and then in the end, when he finally makes it to El Dorado. And so, of course, we need flamenco and palmas and a woman in a huge red dress. And I don't know if people should watch, when they watch the show, Rosemary who did the costumes, Virginia's wearing one costume in the entire show that she just keeps adding on to. So what she wears at the end is actually just everything that's been right. overdressed on top of that, to like build her character's power up to the end, as to take Poe to the El Dorado.
And that, exactly, and she and we should just add, and she's on stilts, which is sort of incredible to watch.
Yeah, yeah.
We're almost out of time here, but I'm wondering, Jeremy, how you prepare for a show like this? I mean, even just those moments before you open your mouth.
Hmm. Well, there's a lot of. What we've been doing thus far to prepare for the show is to make a lot of changes stick for the run. So we're meeting at 5 and we're running around trying to figure out, oh, if we make this change now, this prop has to go to the other side of the stage.
Yeah.
It's the style of theater that Thaddeus and I love to do, it's quite honestly, it's a hugely difficult thing to perform because it's just you and there's all these props and characters that you're playing. I mean, when we did Flamingo Winnebago a couple of years ago here for the festival, that's even more difficult than playing all these different characters and all these crazy costume changes and stuff.
And you have to hide props. I mean, behind that piano, all the props are hidden because you can't go backstage and get something.
Yeah.
You know, Poe never leaves the stage. The minute he walks on stage, he never leaves once.
Well, we could go on, but they're playing my song, and we have to end our conversation. My thanks to all three of you for joining us today on Radio Times. And again, congratulations on Red Eye to Hava de Grasse. Speaking with Thaddeus Phillips, Jeremy, and David Wilhelm, and Red Eye to Hava de Grasse at the Suzanne Roberts Theater tonight, tomorrow, Saturday, and Sunday. And again, part of the Philadelphia Live Arts and Philly Fringe. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. A round of applause for Kevin. And the program is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscoe, and thank you so much for joining us.